Alien self-conscious wearing, and so had slipped off my head and now wore round my neck.
That is a container ship, she said with undisguised pity. You miss the last ferry.
We paid what Lamon considered an exorbitant amount for our narrowboat passage, despite fierce negotiations, and the moment my giant boy lowered me onto my seat, a dozen young men appeared from nowhere and joined us, sitting on every viable piece of the boat's frame and transforming us from private water taxi into public boat. But on the other side of the water, my network reappeared, and we learned that Amy had decided to stay in one of the beach hotels and set out for the village tomorrow. The giant boy was delighted. We paid him again and thus subsidized another trip for some local kids, sailing back the way we'd come. Once on shore, we made our way finally to the village in a beat-up minibus. The idea of two boats and two cabs in a single day was excruciating to Lamin, even if I paid for the second ride, even if the price quoted, which made him wince, would not buy me a bottle of water on Broadway. He sat on the roof of the vehicle with another boy who could not be squeezed in, and as my fellow passengers talked and slept and prayed and ate and fed babies and shouted at the driver to let them off at what appeared to me to be completely deserted intersections, I could hear Lamin beating out a rhythm on the roof over my head, and for 2 hours it was the only language I understood. We reached the village after 10. I was staying with a local family and had never been outside their compound at that hour or realized the total darkness that surrounded us, through which Lamin walked now with complete confidence, as if it were floodlit. I scurried behind him through the many narrow, sandy, trash-strewn paths I could not see, past the corrugated iron sheets that marked each breeze block, single-story compound from the next, until we reached the Al Callow's compound, no grander or taller than the rest, but with a large open waste ground in front of it, in which at least 100 children, in the uniform of their school, the school we were here ultimately to replace, huddled under the canopy of a single mango tree. They'd waited 6 hours to do their dance for a woman called Amy. Now it fell to Lamin to explain why this lady would not be arriving today. But when Lamin had finished speaking, the chief appeared to want it explained to him all over again. I waited as the two men discussed the matter, their hands moving in an animated way, while the children grew ever more bored and agitated, until the women lay aside the drums they would not now play, and told the children finally to stand, and in dribs and drab sent them running back to their homes. I held up my phone. It cast its artificial light over the Al Callow. He was not, I thought, the great African chief Amy had in her mind. Small, ashy, wrinkled and toothless, in a threadbare Man U t-shirt, tracksuit bottoms and plastic Nike house slippers held together with gaffer tape. And how surprised the Al Callow would be, in turn, to hear what a figure he had become for us all in New York. It had started with an email from Miriam. Subject heading, Protocol, which outlined, in Miriam's view, what any visitor to the village must present to its Al Callow upon arrival as a mark of respect. Scrolling through it, Judy released her seal bark and put her phone in my face. This a joke? I read the list. Reading glasses, paracetamol, aspirin, batteries, body wash, toothpaste, antiseptic cream. Don't think so. Miriam doesn't make jokes. Judy smiled fondly at her screen. Well, I think we can swing that. Not many things charmed Judy, but that list did. It charmed Amy even more. And for a few weeks afterwards, whenever any good people of means visited us, in the Hudson Valley House or in Washington Square, Amy would repeat this list with mock solemnity, and then ask everybody present if they could even imagine, and everybody would confess they could hardly even imagine, and seemed very moved and comforted by this failure to imagine. It was taken as a sign of purity, both in the Al Callow and in themselves. But it's just so challenging to make that translation, commented a young man from Silicon Valley on one of these nights. He was leaning over the dining table into a candle centerpiece, and his face seemed lit from below with his own insight. I mean, between one reality and the other, like passing through the matrix.
Everybody at the table nodded and agreed that it was. And later I caught Amy seamlessly adding this dinner party line to her recitations of the Al Callows now famous list as if it were her own.
"What's he saying?"
I whispered to Lamin. I was tired of waiting. I lowered my phone. Lamin put a hand gently on the chief's shoulder, but the old man continued to make his endless, agitated address to the darkness.
"The Al Callow is saying," Lamin whispered, "that things are very difficult here."
The next morning I went with Lamin to the school and charged my phone in the headmaster's office, through the sole outlet in the village, run on a solar-powered generator and paid for by an Italian charity years earlier. Around midday, network mysteriously reappeared. I read through my 50 texts and established I had 2 more days alone here before I would have to go back to the ferry and collect Amy. She was resting in a city hotel. At first, I was excited by this unexpected solitude and surprised myself with all kinds of plans. I told Lamin I wished to go to the famous compound of the rebel slave 2 hours away, and that I wanted to see at last, with my own eyes, the shore from which the ships had left, carrying their cargo of humans destined for my mother's island, and then on to the Americas and Britain, bearing the sugar and the cotton before turning back again, a triangle that had produced, among its numberless consequences, my own existence. Yet 2 weeks earlier, in front of my mother and Miriam, I had called all of this, contemptuously, diaspora tourism. Now I told Lamin I would ride a minibus unaccompanied to the old slave forts that once held my ancestors. Lamin smiled and seemed to agree, but in practice stepped between all such plans and me. Between me and all attempted interactions, personal or economic. Between me and the incomprehensible village. Between me and the elders and me and the children. Meeting any questions or requests with his anxious smile and his favoured, whispered explanation. "Things are difficult here." I was not allowed to walk into the bush, pick my own cashews, help cook any meals, or wash my own clothes. It dawned on me that he saw me as a sort of child, someone to be treated with kid gloves and presented with reality by degrees. Then I realized everyone in the village thought of me that same way. Where grandmothers crouched to eat from the communal bowl, resting on their powerful haunches, gathering up rice and scraps of ladyfish or garden egg in their fingers, I was brought a plastic chair and a knife and fork, because it was assumed, correctly, that I would be too weak to assume the position. As I poured a full litre of water down the drop toilet to flush out a cockroach that disturbed me, not one of the dozen young girls I lived with ever let me know exactly how far she'd walked that day for that litre. When I snuck off by myself to the market to buy a red and purple wrapper for my mother, Lamin smiled his anxious smile but spared me the knowledge of what proportion of his yearly teacher's salary I'd just spent on a single piece of cloth. Towards the end of that first week, I worked out that the preparations for my dinner began moments after my breakfast had been served. But when I tried to approach the corner of the yard where all those women and girls were hunkering in the dust to peel and cut and pound and salt, they laughed at me and sent me back to my leisure to sit on a plastic chair in my dark room and read the American newspapers I'd brought with me, now crumpled and comically irrelevant, so that I never did discover how, exactly, with no oven and no electricity, they made the oven fries I did not want, or the great bowls of more appetizing rice they cooked for themselves. Food preparation was not for me, nor was washing, or fetching water, or pulling up onions, or even feeding the goats and chickens. I was, in the strictest sense of the term, good for nothing. Even babies were handed to me ironically, and people laughed when they saw me holding one. Yes, great care was taken at all times to protect me from reality. They'd met people like me before. They knew how little reality we can take. The night before we were to pick up Amy, I was woken very early by the call to prayer and the hysterical roosters, and finding that it was not yet insanely hot, I got dressed in the darkness and left my compound alone, without any of the small army of women and children I lived with, as Lamin had insisted I must never do, and went looking for Lamin. I wanted to tell him I was going to the old slave fort today, whether he liked it or not. I was going. As morning broke, I found myself followed by many barefoot, curious children.
Good morning. How is your morning?
Like so many shadows, as here and there I paused to say Lamin's name to the dozens of women I passed, already heading off to work on the communal farm. They nodded and pointed me on, through the scrub, down this path and that, round the bright green concrete mosque half-eaten on each side by 12-foot orange termite hills, past all those dusty front yards that were swept at this hour by sullen, half-dressed teenage girls who rested on their brooms to watch me pass. Everywhere I looked, women were working. Mothering, digging, carrying, feeding, cleaning, dragging, scrubbing, building, fixing. I didn't see a man until I found Lamin's compound, finally at the outskirts of the village, before the farmland. It was very dark and dank, even by local standards. No front door, only a bedsheet, no huge wooden couch, only a single plastic chair, no floor covering, only earth, and a tin bucket of water, with which he must have only recently finished washing himself, for he was on his knees beside it, soaking wet in a pair of football shorts. On the breeze block wall behind him, I could make out the crudely drawn logo of Man United, daubed in red paint. Topless, slender, made only of muscle, skin incandescent with his own youth. Flawless. How pale, practically colourless, I looked beside him. It made me think of Tracy, of the many times as a child she'd placed her arm next to mine to check once again that she was still a little paler than me, as she proudly maintained that she was, just in case summer or winter had changed this state of affairs since last she'd checked. I didn't dare tell her that I lay out on our balcony on any hot day, aiming at exactly the quality she seemed to dread. More colour, darkness, for all my freckles to join and merge and leave me with the same deep, dark brown of my mother. But Lamin, like most people in the village, was as many times dark as my mother was to me, and looking at him now, I found the contrast between his beauty and these surroundings to be, among many other things, surreal. He turned and saw me standing over him. His face was full of hurt. I had broken some unspoken contract. He excused himself, stood the other side of a rag curtain that notionally separated one part of the dismal space from the other. But I could still see him, pulling on his pristine white Calvin Klein shirt with the monogram and his white chinos and white sandals, all of it kept white by a means I couldn't imagine, covered as I was every day in red dust. His fathers and uncles mostly wore jellabas. His many young cousins and siblings ran around in the ubiquitous threadbare soccer shirts and crumbling denim, barefoot, but Lamin wore his western whites almost every time I saw him, and a big silver wristwatch, studded with zirconia, whose hands were perpetually stuck at 10:04. On Sunday, when the whole village gathered for a meeting, he wore a tan, bishop-collared suit and sat close to me, whispering in my ear like a UN delegate, translating only whatever he chose to translate of whatever was being discussed. All the young male teachers in the village dressed in this way, in traditional bishop collars or sharp chinos and shirts, with big watches and thin black bags, their flip phones and huge screened Androids always in hand, even if they didn't work. It was an attitude, I remembered, from the old neighbourhood, a way of representing, which in the village meant dressing for a certain part. I am one of the serious, modern young men. I am the future of my country. I always felt absurd next to them. Compared to their sense of personal destiny, I looked like I was in the world by mere accident, having given no thought at all to what I represented, dressed in my wrinkled olive cargo pants and my filthy Converse, dragging a battered rucksack around. Lamin got back on his knees and quietly restarted his first prayer of the day. I had interrupted that, too. Listening to his whispered Arabic, I wondered exactly what form his prayer took. I waited. I looked around me at the poverty Amy hoped to reduce. It was all I could see, and the kinds of questions children ask were the only kinds that came to me. What is this? What's happening? The same mindset had led me on the very first day I'd arrived to the headmaster's office, where I sat sweating under his molten tin roof, frantically trying to get online. Although I could, of course, have Googled what I wanted to know in New York far more quickly, with infinitely more ease, at any time in the previous 6 months. Here it was a laborious process. A page would half load, then crash. The energy from the solar rose and fell and sometimes cut off completely. It took more than an hour. And when the two sums of money I was looking for finally appeared in their adjacent windows, all I did was sit and stare at them for a long time. In the comparison, as it turned out, Amy came out a little ahead. And just like that, the GDP of an entire country could fit into a single person, like one Russian doll into another. 4. That last June of primary school, Tracy's father got out, and we met for the first time. He stood on the communal grass, looking up at us, smiling. Suave, modern, full of a kind of kinetic joy, but also somehow classic, elegant, Bojangles himself. He stood in fifth position, legs apart, in an electric blue bomber jacket with a Chinese dragon on the back and tight white jeans. A thick, rakish moustache and an afro in the old style, with no fades or lines cut into it, and no high top. Tracy's happiness was intense. She reached over the balcony as if to pull her father up to her, yelling at him to come. "Come up here, Dad, come up." But he winked at us and said,
"I've got a better idea. Let's go down the high road."
We ran down and each took a hand. The first thing I noticed was that he had the body of a dancer and moved like a dancer, rhythmically, with force but also with lightness, so that we three didn't just walk along the high road, we promenaded. Everybody looked at us, we strutted in the sunshine, and several people stopped what they were doing and came to hail us, to hail Louis, from across the street, from a grotty window above a hairdresser's, from the doorways of the pubs. As we approached the betting shop, an old Caribbean gentleman in a flat cap and thick woolen vest, despite the heat, stepped in front of us, blocking our way, and asked,
"Them your daughters?"
Louis held up our hands like we were two prize fighters.
"No,"
he said, letting my hand drop.
"Just this one."
Tracy lit up with the glory of it all.
"I hear them say 13 months all you do,"
said the old man, chuckling.
"Lucky, lucky Louis."
He nudged Louis in his neat waist. It was cinched by a thin gold belt like a superhero. But Louis was insulted. He stepped back from the old man, a deep, sliding plié, and loudly sucked his teeth. He corrected the record. Didn't even do 7. The old man drew out a newspaper he'd had tucked into his armpit, unrolled it, and showed Louis a certain page, which he studied before bending down to show it to us. We were told to close our eyes and stick our fingers wherever the mood took us, and when we opened our eyes, we each had a horse under a finger. I can still remember the name of mine. Theory Test. Because 5 minutes later, Louis ran back out through the bookies' doors, scooped me up off the floor, and threw me into the air. £150 won on a £5 stake. We were diverted to Woolworths, and each told to choose whatever we wanted. I left Tracy at the videos, intended for kids like us, the suburban comedies, action films, space sagas, walking on and bending over the big wire bin, the bargain bin, set aside for those who had little money or choice. There were always a lot of musicals in there. Nobody wanted them, not even the old ladies. And I was scavenging through, happily enough, when I heard Tracy, who had not moved on from the modern section, asking Louis,
"So how many can we have?"
The answer was 4, though we were to hurry up about it. He was hungry. I snatched 4 musicals in a blissful panic. Ali Baba Goes to Town, Broadway Melody of 1936, Swing Time, It's Always Fair Weather. The only one of Tracy's purchases I remember is Back to the Future, more expensive than all mine put together. She pressed it to her chest, giving it up only for a moment so that it might be passed to the cashier, and snatching it back again afterwards, like an animal snapping at its food. When we got to the restaurant, we sat at the best table, just by the window. Louis showed us a funny way to eat a Big Mac, dismantling its layers and placing fries above and below each burger, and then putting it all together again.
"You coming to live with us, then?"
Tracy asked.
Don't know about that. What she say?
Tracy stuck her piggy nose in the air.
Don't care what she says.
Both her little hands were screwed into tight fists.
Don't disrespect your mum. Your mum's got her own problems.
He went back up to the counter to get milkshakes. When he returned, he looked burdened, and without introducing the topic in any formal way, he began to talk to us about the inside, about how you found, when you were inside, that it wasn't like the neighborhood. No, not at all. It was very different. Because when you were inside, everybody understood that people had better keep to their own kind. And that's how it was.
Like stayed with like.
There was hardly any mixing. Not like up at the flats. And it wasn't the guards or anyone telling you to do it. That's just the way it was. Tribes stick together. And it even goes by shade, he explained, pulling up his sleeve and pointing at his arm. So all of us that was dark, like me, well, we're over here, tight with each other, always. He drew a line on the formica tabletop. And brown, like you two, is somewhere over here, and Paki is somewhere else, and Indian is somewhere else. White is split, too, Irish, Scottish, English. And in the English, some of them are BNP, and some are all right. Everybody goes with their own, is the point, and it's natural. Makes you think. We sat slurping our milkshakes, thinking. And you learn all kinds of things, he continued. You learn who the real God of the black man is. Not this blue-eyed, long-haired Jesus individual, no. And let me ask you, how comes I never even really heard of him or his name before I get up in there? Look it up. You learn a lot that you can't learn in school, because these people won't tell you nothing. Nothing about African kings, nothing about Egyptian queens, nothing about Muhammad. They hide it all. They hide the whole of our history, so we feel like we're nothing. We feel like we're at the bottom of the pyramid. That's the whole plan. But the truth is, we built the fucking pyramids. Oh, there's a devilishness in them. But one day, God willing, this white day will be done. Louis lifted Tracy onto his lap and jiggled her as if she were a much younger child, and then worked her arms from below, like a puppet, so she seemed to be dancing to the music that was playing through the speakers that nestled between the security cameras. You still dancing? It was a casual question. I could tell he wasn't particularly interested in the answer. But Tracy always took her opportunities, no matter how small, and now she told her father, in a great, happy rush of detail, about all her dance medals from that year, and from the previous year, and of what Miss Isabel had said about her point work, of what all kinds of people said about her talent, and about her upcoming audition for stage school, on which subject I had already heard about as much as I could stand. My own mother would not allow stage school. Not even if I won a full scholarship, of the kind Tracy was betting on. We had been battling over it, my mother and I, ever since I heard that Tracy would be allowed to audition. The thought of having to go to a normal school while Tracy spent her days dancing. Now see, with me, said Louis, tiring suddenly of his daughter's talk. With me, I didn't need dance school. Matter of fact, I used to rule the dance floor. This girl got it all from her daddy. Believe me, I can do all the moves. Ask your mum. Used to even make some money off it back in the day. You look doubtful. To prove it, to allay our doubts, he slipped off his stool and kicked his leg up, jerked his head, shifted the line of his shoulders, spun, stopped on a dime, and ended on the points of his toes. A group of girls who sat across from us in a booth whistled and cheered, and watching him, I felt I understood now what Tracy had meant by placing her father and Michael Jackson in one reality. And I didn't find that she was a liar, exactly, or at least I felt that within the lie there was a deeper truth. They were touched by the same inheritance. And if Louis's dancing happened not to be famous like Michael's, well, this was, to Tracy, only a kind of technicality, an accident of time and place. And now, thinking back on his dancing, writing it all down, I think she was exactly right. Afterwards, we decided to walk with our huge milkshakes back up the high road, stopping again to speak to a few friends of Louis's, or perhaps they were simply people who knew enough about him to fear him, including a young Irish builder hanging one-handed off the scaffolding outside the Tricycle Theatre, his face burnt red from too much work in the sun. He reached down to shake Louis's hand. "Now, if it isn't the playboy of the West Indies!" He was rebuilding the tricycle's roof, and Louis was very struck by this. It was the first time he'd heard about the terrible fire of a few months before. He asked the boy how much it would cost to rebuild, how much he and the rest of Moran's men were getting paid an hour, what cement they were using, and who were the wholesalers. And I looked over at Tracy as she filled up with pride at this glimpse of another possible Louis, respectable young entrepreneur, quick with numbers, good with his staff, taking his daughter round his place of work, holding her hand so tightly. I wished it could be like that for her every day. It didn't occur to me that there would be any consequences to our little outing, but even before I'd got back onto Willesden Lane, somebody had told my mother where I'd been and with whom. She caught hold of me as I walked through the door and slapped the milkshake out of my hand. It struck the opposite wall, very pink and thick, unexpectedly dramatic. And for the rest of the time we lived in that place, we coexisted with a faint strawberry stain. She started in yelling. What did I think I was doing? Who did I think I was with? I ignored all her rhetorical questions and asked her again why I couldn't audition like Tracy. "Only a fool gives up an education," said my mother. And I said, "Well, then maybe I'm a fool." I tried to get by her into my room, my hall of videos behind my back, but she blocked my way, and so I told her, bluntly, that I was not her and did not ever want to be her, that I didn't care about her books or her clothes or her ideas or any of it. I wanted to dance and live my own life. My father emerged from wherever he'd been hiding, gesturing at him. I tried to make the point that if it were up to my father, I'd be allowed to audition, because my father was a man who believed in me, as Tracy's father believed in her. My mother sighed. "Of course he'd let you do it," she said. "He's not worried. He knows you'll never get in." "For God's sake," muttered my father. But he couldn't look at me, and I understood with a stab of pain that what my mother was saying must be true. "All that matters in this world," she explained, "is what's written down. But what happens with this?" She gestured at my body. "That will never matter. Not in this culture. Not for these people. So all you're doing is playing their game by their rules. And if you play that game, I promise you, you'll end up a shade of yourself. Catch a load of babies, never leave these streets, and be another one of these sisters who might as well not exist." "You don't exist," I said. I grabbed at this lion as a child grabs at the first thing to hand. The effect on my mother was beyond anything I could have hoped for. Her mouth turned slack, and all her self-possession and beauty drained from her. She began to cry. We stood at the threshold to my room, my mother with her head bowed. My father had retreated. It was just we two. It took a minute before she found her voice again. She told me, in a fierce whisper, not to take another step. But as soon as she'd said it, she saw her own mistake. It was an admission. This was exactly the time of my life when I could finally take a step away from her. Many steps. I was almost 12. I was already as tall as her. I could dance right out of her life, and so a shift in her authority was inevitable, was happening precisely as we stood there. I said nothing, stepped around her, went into my room, and slammed the door. 5. Ali Baba Goes to Town is a strange film. It's a variation of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, in which Eddie Cantor plays Al Babson, An everyday schmuck who finds himself working as an extra on an Arabian Nights-type picture out in Hollywood. On set, he falls asleep and dreams he's back in 9th-century Arabia. One scene made a very strong impression on me. I wanted to show it to Tracy, but she'd become hard to pin down. She didn't call, and when I tried to call her flat, there was always a pause on the line before her mother told me she was out. I knew she had her legitimate reasons. She was busy preparing for her stage school audition, which Mr. Booth had kindly agreed to assist her with. She rehearsed most weekday afternoons in the church hall, but I wasn't ready to release her into her new life. I made many attempts to ambush her. The doors to the church would be open, sun streaming through the stained glass, Mr. Booth accompanying her on the piano, and if she spotted me spying on her, she'd wave, the adult, distracted greeting of a busy woman, but never once did she come out to talk to me. By some obscure preteen logic, I decided my body was to blame. I was still a lanky, flat-chested child lurking in the doorway, while Tracy, dancing in the light, was already a little woman. How could she have any interest in the things that still interested me?
Nah, don't know it. What's it called again?
I just told you. Ali Baba Goes to Town.
I'd been bold and walked into the church at the end of one of her rehearsals. She was sitting in a plastic chair taking off her tap shoes, while Mr. Booth was still in his corner, messing around with the piece Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine, speeding it up and slowing it down, playing it now as jazz, now as ragtime.
I'm busy. You could come now. I'm busy now.
Mr. Booth packed his music into his bag and wandered over. Tracy's nose shot in the air, sniffing out praise.
Well, that was smashing, he said.
Was it good, really?
Smashing. You danced like a dream.
He smiled and patted her on the shoulder, and a flush of happiness passed over her face. It was the kind of praise I got from my own father daily, no matter what I did. But for Tracy it must have been very rare, for hearing it seemed to change everything, including how she felt about me in that moment. As Mr. Booth made his way slowly out of the church, she smiled, slung her dance bag over her shoulder, and said,
"Let's go."
The scene comes early in the film. A group of men sits on the sandy ground. They seem apathetic, depressed. These, the Sultan tells Al, are the musicians, the Africans, whom nobody can understand, for they speak an unknown language. But Al wants to talk to them, and he tries everything. English, French, Spanish, Italian, even Yiddish. Nothing doing. Then, a brainwave. Heidi, 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 hi. The call of Cab Calloway, and the Africans, recognizing it, leap to their feet and cry out the response, "Ho, de ho, de ho, de ho." Excited, Cantor starts blacking up, right then and there, painting his face with a burnt piece of cork, leaving only those rolling eyes, the elastic mouth.
"What is this? I don't want to watch this."
"Not this bit, just wait. Trace, please, wait."
I took the remote control from her and asked that she sit back on the settee. Now Al was singing to the Africans, a verse that seemed to swing time itself, flashing far ahead to a moment when these Africans would no longer be as they were presently, a time 1,000 years in the future when they would set the tempo the world wants to dance to in a place called Harlem. Hearing this news, the delighted musicians stood up and started dancing and singing on a raised platform in the town square. The Sultana and her advisers look down from a balcony, the Arabians look up from the street. The Arabs are Hollywood Arabs, white in Aladdin costumes. The Africans are black Americans dressed up, loincloths and feathers, outlandish headdresses, and they play primitive musical instruments in a parody of their future Cotton Club incarnations. Trombones made of actual bone, clarinets formed from hollowed-out sticks, that sort of thing. And Cantor, true to the origins of his name, is the bandleader, with a whistle round his neck, which he blows to end a solo or usher a performer off stage. The song reached its chorus. He told them that swing was here to stay, that there was no avoiding it, and so they must choose their partner and dance. Then Cantor blew his whistle, and the wonderful thing happened. It was a girl. A girl arrived. I made Tracy sit as close to the screen as she could. I didn't want there to be any doubt about it. I looked across.
I saw her lips part in surprise, as mine had done the first time I watched it, and then I knew that she could see what I saw. Oh, the nose was different. This girl's nose was normal and flat, and there was, in her eyes, no hint of Tracy's brand of cruelty. But the heart-shaped face, the adorable puffy cheeks, the compact body and yet the long limbs, these were all Tracy. The physical resemblance was so strong, and yet she didn't dance like Tracy. Her arms wheelbarrowed as she moved, her legs flew back and forth. She was a hoofer, not an obsessed technician. And she was funny, walking on her toes or freeze-framing for a second in an absurd comic attitude, on one leg, arms in the air, like the hood ornament of an expensive car. Dressed like the rest, grass skirt, feathers, but nothing could diminish her. For the big finish, the girl came back out on stage and joined all those Americans dressed like Africans, and Candle himself, and they all stood still in a line and leant forward at a 45-degree angle to the floor. It was a move back from the future. A year later, we were all trying it ourselves in the playground, having just seen Michael Jackson in a music video doing the exact same thing. And for weeks after that video first aired, Tracy and me and many other kids in the playground tried our best to imitate the move, but it was impossible. No one could do it. We all fell flat on our faces. At the time, I didn't know how it was done. Now I know. In the video, Michael used wires, and a few years later, when he wanted to achieve the effect live on stage, he wore a pair of anti-gravity shoes. They had a slot in the heel that engaged with a peg in the stage, and he was their co-inventor. The patent is in his name. The Africans of Alibaba nailed their own shoes to the floor. 6. At Amy's hotel, we got into a series of SUVs. It was the full circus on that first trip. Her children were with us, and their nanny, Estelle, and Judy, of course, plus the three other PAs, a PR girl, Granger, a French architect I'd never seen before in my life, a starstruck woman from the Department for International Development, a journalist and photographer from Rolling Stone, and a man called Fernando Carapiciano, our project manager. I watched the sweating bellboys in their white linen uniforms heaving bags into trunks, helping everyone to their seats, and wondered what village they came from. I'd expected to ride with Amy in her car to debrief her, for what it was worth, on my week's reconnaissance. But when Amy saw Lamin, her eyes widened, and the first thing she said to him after, "Hello," was, "You should ride with me." I was directed to the second car with Carapiciano. He and I were to pass the time together, so we were told, ironing out the details. The drive back to the village was uncanny. All the difficulties I had come to expect from that journey were now absent, as when in a dream the dreamer is lucid and able to manipulate everything around her. No checkpoints, not any longer, and no potholed roads bringing us to a standstill. And instead of the enervating, stifling heat, a perfectly air-conditioned 21-degree environment and an ice-cold bottle of water in my hand. Our convoy, which included a pair of jeeps filled with government officials and a police motorcade, moved swiftly along streets that seemed at times to have been artificially cleared, at others artificially populated, lined with flag-waving children like a stage set. And we took an odd, elongated route, weaving through the electrified tourist strip, and then on through a series of suburban enclaves I had not realized existed, where huge, unfinished houses, blighted with rebar, struggled to rise up from behind their fortress walls. Under the influence of this state of unreality, I kept seeing versions of my mother's face everywhere, in young girls running down the street, in old women selling fish in the markets, and once in a young man hanging off the side of a minibus. When we got to the ferry, it was empty but for us and our cars. I wondered what Lamin made of it all. Carapiciano I didn't know very well, and the only time we'd spoken before I'd made a fool of myself. It was on the plane to Togo 6 months earlier, back when Togo was still on the shortlist, before Amy had offended that tiny nation by suggesting, in an interview, that its government did nothing for their people. "What's it like?" I'd asked, leaning over him, looking out of the porthole window and meaning, I must admit, Africa. "I have not been," he said, coldly, without turning round. "But You practically live here. I read your resume.
No. Senegal, Liberia, Côte d'Ivoire, Sudan, Ethiopia, yes. Togo, never.
Oh, well, you know what I mean.
He'd turned to me, red-faced, and asked, if we were flying to Europe and you wanted to know what France was like, would it help if I described Germany? Now I tried to make amends, small talk, but he was busy with a huge sheaf of papers, on which I spotted graphs I couldn't follow, sets of statistics from the IMF. I felt a little sorry for him, stuck with us and our ignorance. He was so far outside his natural milieu. I knew he was 46, had a PhD, was an economist by training, with a background in international development, and that, like Miriam, he'd worked at Oxfam for many years. She was the one who'd recommended him to us in the first place. He'd spent most of the 90s managing aid projects in East and West Africa, in remote villages without television. And one interesting consequence of this, for me anyway, was that he really did not have a very clear idea who Amy was, beyond having registered her name, vaguely, as a phenomenon of his youth. Now he was having to spend all of his time with her, and therefore with people like Mary Beth, Amy's ditzy second assistant, whose job consisted entirely of sending emails, dictated by Amy, to other people and then reading out the replies. Or grim Laura, assistant number 3, who reigned over Amy's muscle aches, toiletries and nutrition, and happened to believe that the moon landings were staged. He had to listen to Judy read the star signs out each morning and plan her day accordingly. Amid the insanity of Amy's world, I should have been the closest thing he had to an ally, but every conversation we attempted went awry somehow. The way he understood the world was so genuinely alien to me that it felt as if he occupied a parallel reality, which I didn't doubt was the real one, but which I couldn't speak to use a favorite phrase of his. Amy, equally helpless before a graph, liked him because he was Brazilian and handsome, with rich, curly black hair and lovely gold glasses that made him look like an actor playing an economist in a movie. But it was obvious from the start there would be trouble for them ahead. Amy's way of communicating her ideas relied on a shared understanding of Amy herself, of her legend, and Fern, as she called him, had no context for any of that. He was excellent at ironing out the details. Architectural plans, government negotiations, land contracts, all the various practical considerations. But when it came to speaking directly with Amy about the project itself, which for her was primarily a personal and emotional undertaking, he was out of his depth. But what does it mean when she is saying to me, let's make it kind of an illuminated ethos? He pushed his glasses up his handsome nose and examined his many notes, the result, I presumed, of having dutifully transcribed every little piece of nonsense that had fallen from Amy's mouth during their 8-hour flight together. He held the paper up as if it might resolve itself into sense if only he stared at it long enough. Maybe I misunderstand. In what way can a school be illuminated?
No, it's a reference to an album of hers, Illuminated, from 97. She thinks of it as her most positive album. So the lyrics are, well, they're sort of like, hey girls, go get your dreams, blah blah, you're strong, blah blah, never give up, that sort of thing. So she's basically saying, I want this to be an empowering school for girls.
He looked bewildered. But why not just say this?
I patted him gently on his shoulder. Fernando, don't worry. It's going to be fine.
I should listen to this album?
Honestly, I don't think that would help.
Up ahead, in the next car, I could see Amy leaning out of the passenger seat with her arm over the door, happily engaged with every wave or whistle or scream of delight from the street, which were, I felt pretty certain, not responses to Amy herself, but to this shiny cavalcade of SUVs rolling through rural areas in which not one in 200 owned a car. In the village, out of curiosity, I often commandeered the phones of the young teachers, put my earphones in, and listened to the 30 or so songs they tended to play on rotation, some of which came free with their minutes, others, especially beloved, they had spent precious credit download. Hip-hop, R&B, soca, reggae, ragga, grime, dubstep, highlife. Ringtone scraps of the whole glorious musical diaspora could be heard, but rarely any white artists, and never Amy.
Now I watched her smile and wink at the many soldiers, who, relieved of their usual activity, stood aimlessly at the side of the road, guns by their side, watching us pass. And wherever there was music, wherever kids were dancing, Amy would clap her hands to get their attention and imitate their moves as best she could while still sitting down. This element of roadside rolling chaos that so affected and disturbed me, like a zoetrope unfurled and filled with every form of human drama, women feeding children, carrying them, talking to them, kissing them, hitting them, men talking, fighting, eating, working, praying, animals living and dying, wandering down the street, bleeding from their necks, boys running, walking, dancing, pissing, shitting, girls whispering, laughing, frowning, sitting, sleeping. All of this delighted Amy. She leant so far out of that window, I thought she might fall right through her beloved matrix and into it. But then she was always happiest in ungovernable crowds. Until her insurance company stopped her doing it, she often crowd-surfed, and it never frightened her, as it did me, to be suddenly swarmed by people in an airport or the lobby of a hotel. Meanwhile, the only thing I could see through my tinted window did not appear to surprise or alarm her, and when I made some reference to it in the few minutes we were together, standing on the gangway, watching our cars roll onto the spookily empty ferry and her children run delightedly up the cast-iron steps to the upper deck, she turned to me and snapped, "Jesus Christ, if you're going to be shot by every fucking sign of poverty you see here, this is going to be a mighty long trip. You're in Africa!" Just as if I'd asked why it was light outside and been told, "It's daytime." 7. All we had was her name. We found it in the credits. Jenny Lagon. We had no idea where she'd come from, if she was alive or dead, if she'd made any other films. We had only these 4 minutes from Ali Baba. Well, I had them. If Tracy wanted to watch them, she had to come round, which she began to do every now and then, like Narcissus bending over a pool of water. I understood it wouldn't take her long to learn the whole routine, excepting the impossible lean, but I wasn't going to give her the video to take home. I knew better than that. I knew when I had collateral. And I began to spot Lagon here and there, bit parts in movies I'd seen many times. There she was as a maid to Ann Miller, wrestling with a baby pug, and as a tragic mulatto, dying in the arms of Cab Calloway, and once more a maid, helping Betty Hutton get dressed. These discoveries, widely spaced, sometimes many months apart, became a reason to call Tracy. And even if her mother answered, Tracy would come round right away, with no hesitation or excuses. She sat inches from the television screen, ready to point out this or that moment of action or expression, an emotion passing over Jenny's face, a variation in one step or another, and interpreting everything she saw with that sharpness of insight I felt I lacked, that I considered, at this point, Tracy's possession alone. A gift for seeing that seemed to have only its outlet and expression here, in my living room, in front of my television, and which no teacher ever saw, and no exam ever managed to successfully register or even note, and of which, perhaps, these memories are the only true witness and record. One thing she failed to notice, and I didn't want to tell her. My parents had broken up. I only knew it myself because my mother told me it was so. They still lived in the same flat and slept in the same room. Where else could they go? Real divorces were for people who had lawyers and new places to live. There was also the question of my mother's capabilities. We all three knew that in divorces the father left, but my father could not leave. There was no question of that. Who, in his absence, would tape up my knee when I fell, or remember my medicine was to be taken, or calmly comb the nits out of my hair? Who would come to me when I had my night terrors? Who would wash my stinking yellow sheets the next morning? I don't mean that my mother didn't love me, but she was not a domestic person. Her life was in her mind. The fundamental skill of all mothers, the management of time, was beyond her. She measured time in pages. Half an hour, to her, meant 10 pages read, or 14, depending on the size of the type. And when you think of time in this way, there isn't time left for anything else. There's no time to go to the park or get ice cream, no time to put a child to bed, no time to listen to the teary recounting of a nightmare. No, My father could not leave. One morning when I was brushing my teeth, my mother walked into the bathroom, sat on the rim of our avocado bathtub, and euphemistically outlined the new arrangement. At first, I could hardly understand her. She seemed to be taking a very long time to get to the point of whatever she really wanted to say. Speaking of child psychology theories and places in Africa, where children were raised not by their parents, but by a village. And other matters I either didn't understand or didn't care about. But finally she pulled me to her, hugged me very tightly and said, "Your dad and me, we're going to live as brother and sister." I can remember thinking this was the most perverse thing I'd ever heard. I was to be left an only child, while my parents became siblings to each other. My father's initial reaction must have been similar, because for several days after that it was warfare in the flat, all-out warfare, and I had to sleep with two pillows pressed to my ears. But when he at last understood that she was not joking, that she would not change her mind, he fell into a depression. He began to spend whole weekends on the sofa, watching television, while my mother kept to the kitchen and to her high stool, busy with the homework for her degree. I went to dance class alone. I ate my tea with one or the other of them, no longer with both. A little while after my mother's announcement, my father made a baffling decision. He went back to delivering the post. It had taken him 10 years to become a delivery office manager, but in his sadness, he read Orwell's Coming Up for Air, and this novel had convinced him that he'd be better off doing honest labour, as he put it, and have the rest of his days free to get the education he never had, than work at a soulless desk job that used up all his time. It was the kind of impractical, high-principled action that my mother usually appreciated, and the timing of the announcement did not seem, to me, accidental. But if winning her back was his plan, it didn't work. He rose once again each morning at 3 and returned at 1 in the afternoon, often ostentatiously reading some sociological textbook nicked from my mother's shelves. But although my mother respectfully asked after his morning's work and occasionally after his reading, she did not fall back in love with him. After a while they stopped talking to each other altogether. The weather in the flat changed. In the past, I had always had to wait for one of the rare gaps in my parents' decade-long argument, into which I would then try to insert myself. Now I could speak without interruption, if I wanted, to either of them, but it was already too late. In the fast-forward style of city childhoods, they were no longer the most important people in my life. No, I really didn't care what my parents thought of me any longer. Only my friends' judgment counted, now more than ever. And sensing this, I suspect, more and more she chose to withhold it. 8. It was said later that I was a bad friend to Amy, always had been, that I was only waiting for the right moment to hurt her, even to ruin her. Maybe she believes that. But it's a good friend who wakes a friend from her dream. At first I thought that it wouldn't have to be me at all, that the village itself would wake her up, because it didn't seem possible to stay dreaming in that place, or to think of yourself as in any way an exception. I was wrong about that. On the northern outskirts of the village, beside the road that led to Senegal, there stood a large pink brick house of 2 stories, the only one of its kind for miles around, abandoned, but basically finished except for the windows and doors. It had been built on remittances, Lamin told me, sent back by a local young man who'd been doing well driving a cab in Amsterdam until his luck changed and the money abruptly stopped. Now the house, empty for a year, would have a new life as our base of operations. By the time we reached it, the sun was going down, and the Minister for Tourism was pleased to show us the bare bulbs burning from the ceiling of each room. "And every time you visit," we were told, "it will only be better and better." The village had been waiting for light a long time, since the coup, over 20 years earlier. Yet in a couple of days, Amy had managed to convince the relevant authorities to attach a generator to this shell of a house, and there were sockets to charge all our phones, and a team of workmen had affixed Perspex windows and put in serviceable MDF doors, beds for everybody, and even a stove.
The children were thrilled. It was like camping. And for Amy, the two nights she was scheduled to spend here took the form of an epical adventure. I heard her tell the Rolling Stone reporter how important it was to stay in the real world among the people. And the next morning, alongside the formal photographed events, soil-breaking schoolgirls dancing, many images were taken of Amy in this real world, eating from the communal bowls, crouching down with ease alongside the women, using the muscles she had developed indoor cycling, or showing off her agility, climbing the cashew trees with a group of young boys. After lunch, she put on her olive cargo pants, and together we toured the village with the woman from DFID, whose task it was to point out areas of particular deprivation. We saw drop toilets crawling with hookworm, a forgotten half-constructed clinic, many airless rooms with corrugated iron roofs in which children slept 10 to a bed. Afterwards, we toured the communal gardens to witness the limits of subsistence farming. But as we entered the field, the sun happened to be casting long, captivating shadows, and the potato plants were hugely bushy and green, and the trees looped with vines, the lushness of everything creating an effect of extraordinary beauty. The women, young and old, had a utopian look to them, in their colourful wrappers, pulling weeds from the ground, chatting to each other as they worked, shouting across the rows of peas or peppers, laughing at each other's jokes. Spotting us approaching, they straightened up and wiped the sweat from their faces with their own headscarves, if they wore them, with their hands, if not.
"Good day to you. How is the day?"
"Oh, I see what's happening here," said Amy to an ancient old woman who had been so bold as to put her arm around Amy's tiny waist. "You gals get to really talk to each other out here. No men in sight. Yeah, I can just imagine what goes on." The woman from DFID laughed too much. I thought of how little I could imagine of what went on. Even the simplest ideas I'd brought with me did not seem to work here when I tried to apply them. I was not, for example, standing at this moment in a field with my extended tribe, with my fellow black women. Here there was no such category. There were only the Seri women, the Wolof and the Mandinka, the Serahuli, the Fula and the Jola, the last of whom, I was told once, grudgingly, I resembled, if only in basic facial architecture, same long nose, same cheekbones. From where I stood now, I could hear the call to prayer coming from the square concrete minaret of the green mosque, rising above the trees and over this village where women covered and uncovered were sisters and cousins and friends to each other, were each other's mothers and daughters, or were covered in the morning and uncovered in the afternoon, simply because some age mates had come visiting. Boys and girls, and one of them had offered to plait their hair. Here, where Christmas was celebrated with a startling fervour, and all the people of the book were considered brothers, sisters. While I, representing the utterly godless, was nobody's enemy. No, just someone who should properly be pitied and protected, so one of the girls I shared a room with explained to me, as you would a calf whose mother died in the having of her. Now I watched girls lining up at the well, filling their huge plastic tubs with water, and then lifting these tubs onto their heads to begin the long walk back to the village. A few of them I recognized from the compound I had been staying in this past week. The twin cousins of my host, Hawa, as well as three of her sisters. I waved at them all, smiling. They acknowledged me with a nod.
"Yes, we're always struck by how much the women and girls do here," said the woman from DFID, sotto voce, following my line of sight. "They do the housework, you see, and then also all the fieldwork. And as you'll see, it's largely women running both the school and the market. Girl power, indeed."
She bent down to feel the stem of a garden egg, and Amy took the opportunity to turn to me, cross her eyes, and stick her tongue out. The DFID woman straightened up and glanced over at the growing queue of girls.
"Many of them should be in school, of course, but unfortunately their mothers need them here. Then you think of those young boys we just saw lounging about in a hammock among the cashews."
"Education is the answer to development for our girls and women," Lamin piped up, with the slightly wounded and weary air, I thought, of someone who had endured a great many lectures from representatives of DFID. "Education, education, education.
Amy gave him a dazzling smile. That's what we're here for, she said. During all the activities of the day, Amy kept Lamin close, mistaking his tendency to whisper for a special intimacy between them. And after a while she began whispering back at him, flirting like a schoolgirl. Dangerous, I thought, in front of the ever-present journalist, but there was not a moment when we were alone that I could firmly tell her so. Instead,